Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us once again on The Final Word. We continue in our exposition of the book of Isaiah. We come now to Isaiah chapter 31. We're going to talk about, in a figure, the sin, the mistake, more than a mistake, the sin, but it is a great mistake, of going down to Egypt rather than trusting in God. You see, Egypt is one biblical symbol of worldly power and the place of bondage. To go back, spiritually speaking, to the former place of bondage and to seek deliverance from that source rather than from the Lord who redeemed Israel from Egypt is a huge insult and slap in the face to our God. God offers to be our protector. And when we turn to Egypt, now I'm figuratively speaking, to protect us, to provide for us, to sustain us, then we're not only stirring up the holy indignation of God against us and making ourselves his enemy instead of letting him be our friend and our protector, but we're bringing the prospect of real trouble upon ourselves. God had offered through Isaiah to be the protector of Judah from the Assyrians. They spurned that offer. They went to Egypt to seek an alliance that would fortify them against any injury from the Assyrians. And that amounted to, in spirit, rejection of God and was functionally a declaration of unbelief in his promises and in God's power. Let's read at least a portion of this passage, and then I will continue with the exposition, but that gives us an appropriate introduction. The prophet cries out, "Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help against the Assyrians. Woe to those who rely on horses, military might, and trust in chariots, because they are many, and in horsemen, because they are very strong. But they do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord. Yet the Lord also is wise, and he will bring disaster, and he does not retract his words, but he will arise against the house of evildoers." And he's talking about the leadership of Judah. "And the Lord will arise against the help of the workers of iniquity." The Egyptians, what are they? They're mere men. They are not God, and their horses are flesh, and they are not spirit. So the Lord will stretch out his hand, his indignant hand, and he who helps, he who comes to help you, whose help you've purchased, these Egyptian mercenaries, they will stumble, and he who is helped will fall, and all of them will come to an end together. For thus says the Lord to me, the prophet says, "As the lion or the young lion growls over his prey, against which a band of shepherds is called out to try to defend the flock, the lion or the young lion will not be terrified at the voice of such a band of shepherds," I'm paraphrasing for clarity, "nor will the lion pride be disturbed at their noise." Those shepherds can stand over there and yell and hoot and do whatever, but that's not going to scare off a lion pride or a lion. "So will the Lord of hosts come down to wage war on Mount Zion and on its hill. Like flying birds, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem." Why would he protect it? It's for his name's sake. He made a promise. He said he would. They won't trust in him, but he's going to protect it anyway, just to show them that he is God and he's going to do it in such a way that it is clear that he has done it. He will protect it. He will deliver it. He will pass over Jerusalem. He will rescue it. Now the appeal of the prophet. Return to him from whom you have deeply defected, O sons of Israel. For in that day every man will cast away his silver idols and his gold idols, which your hands have made as a sin. And the Assyrian will fall by the sword, not of man, and a sword, not of man, will devour him. So he will not escape the sword, and his young men will become forced laborers. And his rock will pass away because of panic, and his princes will be terrified at the war standard, declares the Lord, whose fire is in Zion and whose furnace is in Jerusalem. Now, let's talk about all of that. There's a spiritual application to this military situation, this historical military situation. Let me differentiate the unbelief of the Judeans in seeking aid from the Egyptians from faith in doing our proper due diligence in the various issues and tests of life. Normally, in delivering us from our emergencies and crises, God does so through various agents and means. For example, normally God does not heal our diseases and illnesses by direct intervention. He doesn't. The healing from our diseases and illnesses, when it's by direct intervention, comes under the category of the miraculous. The miraculous is not the normal. It's the rarity. God expects us always to trust in him as our healer, but in that process to use the secondary means that God has made accessible to us. When we find relief, of course we thank our physician or physicians and rejoice in effective medications. But we praise our sovereign God, who in his compassionate providence made those means available to us. For we know, whether they know or not, to whom the credit ultimately belongs. Take a situation of seeking a job. We don't just sit home and wait for the phone to ring. Now bear with me, all this has an important bearing on this passage. Most of us know God does not usually supply manna from heaven, but he prompts us in the spirit of due diligence to cover our bases and to do all the appropriate things to advertise our availability and qualifications for work. When we land a provident job, we thank God for his gracious providence in leading us to an opening and giving us favor in the eyes of those during the hiring. So here's the bottom line. It is no lack or lapse of faith on our part as saints to do all those sensible, common sense things on the human side in cooperation with the operation of God's kind providence. As a matter of fact, folks, it would be presumptuous of us to expect God to do for us what we can do for ourselves. I need a loaf of bread. I don't expect God to hand deliver it. He's given me legs to walk. He's given me money and a car to drive and gasoline to put in it to go to the store and pick it up for myself. And I thank him that I can. It is not faith, in my case, to ask God to help me get out of bed in the morning or to prepare myself for bed and tuck me in. That, again, would be gross presumption, expecting God to be my nanny and expecting God to do what he has made me able to do for myself. So where does unbelief enter in, and where do we flirt with going down to Egypt in principle, as these people did in practice, and so offended and insulted God, and expressed so visibly their disbelief? Where disbelief, lack of trust in our God, enters the picture is when I am attempting to save the bacon by some means or measure, contrary to what God has told me, when I am resorting to some other fix or fixer, because I simply do not have enough confidence in God's promises, or do not have enough confidence in God's power, or do not have enough confidence in God's provision, or whatever, to let God do what He has clearly promised to do without any help. If I have some bitter enemy who has bad intentions, and the Lord tells me, as He does, "Jim, vengeance is mine. You keep your hands out of it, and let me deal with the problem." Now that's God's promise. But should I get fearful the enemy is getting the drop on me, so to speak, that the enemy has gained a big edge, and I get very nervous and start fearing that the Lord is not moving fast enough, or is not going to move at all, or I get fearful that maybe He's not even capable of dealing with a problem that seems way too big, and so I preempt the Lord by taking matters into my own hands, passing it off as due diligence, and I start employing or deploying various countermeasures, then that is unbelief. Well, the latter is what Israel is doing that Isaiah is warning about. And that's what we do when in our extremities we push the Lord aside and we say in effect, "Don't bother, I'll just take care of it my own way. I have more confidence, Lord, in my way of handling things." We may not say it out loud, but we say it in effect. Whenever we take that approach, we are in a figure of speech going down to Egypt. They did it literally. We can do it spiritually. When we commit that sin, we really, really blunder. Because at the end of the day, going down to Egypt is not only a sin, but it's a sin that's going to complicate our lives. That's what King Asa did. King Asa was facing a great threat from the northern kingdom on a certain occasion. They were really encroaching on his territory. So instead of trusting in the Lord as he had been doing up till that time, all of a sudden he had been on the throne, he had been powerful long enough and had gotten cocky and gotten confident in his diplomatic skills, so he ordered his envoys to go up to Syria and to bribe King Ben-Hadad to come in behind Baasha, the northern regent, and to pull him off Asa's back. And it worked. It worked. But the Lord told him, 2 Chronicles 16:9, that the Lord seeks a man whose heart is wholly right with him. The eye of the Lord runs to and fro throughout the whole earth to seek a heart that is whole toward him. Herein you have acted foolishly, King Asa, foolishly, and henceforth you'll have wars. There's a way, the proverb says, that seems right to a man. To a man all on his own, but the end thereof the ways of death and disaster. Well, when we don't trust in the Lord, when we commit this sin that we've, in a metaphorical way, have called going down to Egypt, we really blunder, because at the end of the day, this will only bring complication and confusion to our lives, aside from the worst fact of dishonoring God. Going down to Egypt will never be any help, even if it temporarily seems to. Worst of all, it puts us at a distance from God, who sits back, as it were, and lets us pay the piper for our folly. The troubles only ramify. Well, let me ask the question, what are some ways that we can go down to Egypt, as these folk did, for deliverance from our enemies, human or circumstantial? Well, take, for example, joblessness. We mentioned this earlier. Obviously, we ought to do our due diligence. Search all of the conventional sources these days for job openings. Network with other people and do those kinds of things. Do what we can do. Do what makes common sense to do. But we can sometimes, for example, maybe settle for an employment that is less than kosher and not one that would honor God. That's going down to Egypt. We can have financial issues. A lot of people have financial issues, and there's a way of dealing with those that is not honoring to God. And when we do that, it is in effect going down to Egypt, seeking solutions in some ways that insult the Lord. They may work temporarily, but in the end, they will work against us. But the main problem is they dishonor God. Then there are marital issues. We can go down to Egypt there. People do all the time. You've got a problem. You've got a big problem. You've got a problem that if I heard it, I'd say, boy, that's heavy. Of course, there are a lot of people that have got those heavy problems. But you know, when we enter into marital vows, those are sacred vows. And when we say to God, for better or worse, and until death do us part, and we run out and we form an adulterous relationship to heal our wounds, either formally or informally, we go out and shed a husband or wife without biblical grounds, there has been no infidelity, then that is another form of going down to Egypt. It insults God. It does not give him a chance to solve our problems or ameliorate them or make them bearable. We're saying that your way is not the best way. I've got a better way. I've got a human solution to this problem. It's one that is used by multitudes of people. I want out of this. If you won't let me out of it, then I'm going to get out of it. I've got an enemy. It's my husband. It's my wife. And I'm going to fix it. Well, there are biblical grounds for doing so, and then there are not biblical grounds. That's going down to Egypt, and that will not make your life better. It'll make it worse. And the main reason it'll make it worse is because it's going to put a wedge between you and fellowship with your God. It's going to put a burden of guilt on your heart. And that, like Adam and Eve, will just do nothing but start you running from God. It'll create a callousness there that'll never be good for you spiritually. And people do the same thing with business issues. They run into problems instead of trusting in the Lord with their business or their profession. They find some solution, some business solution, some professional solution that is less than kosher. They do not trust in the Lord, and they go running down to Egypt. Well, that just gives you some idea. We won't draw those out, but people do that all the time. These people did it to protect themselves from the Assyrians. God said he would protect them. He promised them. They weren't guessing about that. It was not a shot in the dark to trust in the Lord. The Lord had sent his prophet and said that he would protect them from the Assyrians. But the leadership, and the leadership was a reflection of the general populace, they would not trust in the Lord. They thought a better way, a more secure way of working it out. They would just go down to the powerful Egyptians. They'd always been a great nation in that day, and they would enlist their military force to back them up and to back the Assyrians off. Well, it didn't work that way. In verse 2, we have prophetic sarcasm in the form of huge understatement. You people think you're so smart. I've got a news flash for you people. God, in case it got past you, he also is wise, to say the least, and he will strip your gears for these acts of unbelief. He will orchestrate in his indignation disaster. He's not about to retract his words, Isaiah said. The ship has sailed. His purpose is sealed. You've insulted the Holy One of Israel. Now he's going to rise up against you in his providential operations. Everything will backfire against evildoers and the so-called help of those workers of iniquity, the Egyptians. And in verse 3, Isaiah says, here's another piece of breaking news for you blind people. You magnify men who put their pants on one leg at a time, just like you, which should bring little comfort to you. This is all very sarcastic. By your actions, you act like they are God. You don't know the difference between an elephant and an ant. Their horses are mere flesh, for heaven's sake. They're not the Spirit of God. You diminish God and you magnify men and horse flesh. Do you know what you're going to get for your trouble and your treasure? God's going to stretch out his hand of punishment for your insulting ways. The result will be that your Egyptian help, it's going to prove a non-starter. They will fall flat on their faces, you will fall flat on yours, and all of you will come to a miserable end together. You should never have parked there. You were warned and warned, and now you're going to pay the consequences. So he says in verse 4, no thanks to you, the Lord, as he promised, is going to protect and deliver Jerusalem. That's the symbolic seat of his presence. He's going to protect it like a mighty lion against a band of shepherds who've been called out to chase it off. He will protect it, and like a lion growling over his prey, the shepherds have no repelling effect whatever. Look, God will accomplish his plan. He will protect Jerusalem. As he said, he will not be deterred by men or means. He will protect it and deliver it, no thanks to you. He will pass over it like a bird and rescue it. So in verse 5, there's still hope, despite yourselves and coming destruction. How can you save yourselves? The same yesterday, today, and forever, where God is concerned. Return to him from whom you've deeply defected, O sons of Israel. I will tell you this, Isaiah says, when God is finished with his punishing work, you will do a finishing work on your beautiful and valuable idols in which you've so vainly trusted. When God's finished, you will find out then, however precious they were on the outside with all their precious metals, that they're essentially worthless, and you'll pitch them in the garbage as worthless debris. They won't mean flip then, when God's finished. In verse 8, he says the Assyrians will fall, all right, by a sword, but not a sword of man, nor the Egyptians, nor anyone else. A sword not of man will devour the enemy. I'm telling you this now so you can confirm it later. He will devour the enemy you so feared that you in panic turned to the Egyptians to save you. The Assyrian army will be decimated by the hand of God. I'm telling you now, they will panic. What is left of them, they'll cut and run for home. Those not cut down by the sword will become slaves. Slaves of the conquering and newly ascendant Babylonians, he means. The stronghold or high fortress of the Assyrians will be abandoned. It'll be destroyed because its defenders are too panicked to stick around, terrified by the appearance of the military standard of the onrushing Babylonian army. This is well down the road yet. But he's telling them in advance. So unaccustomed were the mighty Assyrians to their might and hegemony, that when they saw from a distance a mighty, fast-moving force of Chaldeans coming against them, with battle standards flying in the wind, they hit the panic button, took off like jackrabbits, leaving their own impregnable fortress to defend itself. So declares the Lord, whose altar with its cleansing fire or furnace was in Jerusalem, the symbolic seat of his presence. So the prophet, through the lens of the Spirit here, coalesces the defeat of the Assyrian army in Judah and the final destruction of the Syrian Empire many years later at the hands of the Babylonians. This phenomenon is another example of the forecast of events separated by time, but episodes undifferentiated and seen by the prophets as if in close succession, like the first and second comings of Christ. In reading prophecy, one always has to keep this predictive phenomenon in mind. Today, had there been a prophet like Isaiah in the 18th or 19th centuries, say he had warned the world of great conflict and bloodshed on a global scale, if such a prophet had existed, he might have coalesced or conflated World War I and World War II, standing at a distant prophetic perspective, so that the picture would seem like the forecast of one continuous event, though in fact, World War I and World War II, two great outbursts of world conflict, were separated in time by more than two decades. Well, this is quite a chapter, and it bears so poignantly upon our own times. It is time-bound in one sense, but you get down underneath it, you scrape it out, and you look at what is timeless, and we can see the correlation between this government and its people turning to Egypt for political and military salvation instead of turning to the Lord, and see in principle how it is that we today can replicate the same sin and we can bring upon ourselves the same kinds of disasters, complicate our lives, but worst of all, really dishonor God by our mistrust. Well, thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.